The push to legalize recreational marijuana here in Florida. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a closer look at the fractured state of Florida's cannabis community and attempts to get a recreational marijuana initiative on next year's ballot. Where do you stand on legalizing marijuana fully in Florida? Call us up now, 549-2937. Then later, a closer look at Jacksonville's consolidation and how it's impacting big issues today as we speak to author Chris Hand. But first this hour, what do you think about the push for recreational use of marijuana? The cannabis community in Florida is trying to get a ballot initiative on next year's ballot, but there's actually more than one. We're going to take a closer look now as we welcome Giorgio Valentino, editor at Folio Weekly. Good morning.
Good morning.
Cannabis columnist Shelton Hull.
Good morning.
And on the line, Sally Peoples. She's a partner at Vicente Cederberg and a member of Florida's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning.
So here's our question to callers. Where do you stand on the push to legalize marijuana in Florida? Chances are there will be an amendment that you'll consider on the 2020 ballot to vote this up or down. If it passes, Florida would join a number of other states that have legalized marijuana for recreational use. What do you think? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Giorgio, editor of Folio Weekly, let's begin with you. This is a cover story in this week's Folio. Why devote so much space to this?
Well, because the clock is ticking on the possibility of having an amendment on the November 2020 ballot. The deadline for getting enough petitions is February. And it just seems that the activist community is starting to get a little bit fractured. They're squabbling amongst themselves, and it seems to me, I'm operating under the assumption that if the amendment is on the ballot in November, it's going to pass. I mean, if you ask people thumbs up or thumbs down, it's mostly thumbs up. The question is there enough activists organization to get it done by February? And there has to be a certain amount of petitions signed by then.
Okay, Shelton Hull, so when people go to the polls, they may not be totally clear what they're voting for. There are different measures going on.
Yeah, not being clear on the measure, that's kind of a universal theme around here in this city. You need about 766,000 votes, signed petitions in order to get it on the ballot. That's about 3.5% of the state's population. Right now, the two organizations working on it have combined a little bit over 200,000 signatures lined up. And there are two different proposals being levied, and they're essentially the same, except one has a stipulation allowing for home grow of marijuana, which means customers, patients, whatever, can grow their own stuff and not have to go through a retailer in order to do it. And there's some dispute among the people like making these petitions as to whether that should be allowed or not. And so that's the division between the two. And they're kind of going at cross purposes. Now, one group has about 100,000 signatures. The other has about 100,000 signatures. I would assume that a good portion of those overlap. So as far as unique signatures, you're talking maybe 150,000.
Okay. Sally Kent Peebles, you're on the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Of course, cannabis is legal for medical use in this state. Recreational use, though, that's another matter altogether. It's a bit more divisive of an issue than people using cannabis to cure what ails them. What are your thoughts about this from where you sit?
Well, as you know, I came from Colorado, and where we do have adult use legalized there. And I think in Florida, it's about time that we legalize here. There's three main reasons for that. Number one, criminalizing marijuana use disproportionately harms our youth and people of color, while really failing to lower the access or the use of it. It also strengthens those cartels south of the border who financially benefit from marijuana prohibition. You know, legalizing marijuana would really cut off some of their revenue stream and could help reduce crime. Secondly, there's, the economic benefits that are touted a lot. It's a job creator. It can generate tax revenue, law enforcement would save money, prison system would save money by no longer focusing on this nonviolent issue. And then finally, this ties into the vaping issue we're seeing across the country right now. Regulating marijuana really promotes consumer safety. Regulation of marijuana means these products would be tested for toxins and pesticides. Some of this vaping issue we're seeing appears to be limited primarily to black market, unregulated vapes. And if this was a regulated market, we'd have the FDA overseeing this. So this is, I think legalization would actually solve more problems than it would create.
Interesting. Let's go to some calls now. Where do you stand on the legalization of marijuana in Florida? 549-2937. Charles is in Riverside. Hey, Charles, good morning.
Hey, Melissa. I am super in favor of legalizing marijuana for recreational use. I don't think that it's really... I mean, is there anybody out there who really thinks that we have a broad array of societal issues that are related to people consuming cannabis?
Charles, thanks for that. Giorgio.
I think a lot of people are at that point. I think if it makes it to the general, makes it to the ballot, it's in. The question is whether we can get our act together. The petitions, keep in mind, 766,000 signed petitions, those are not cumulative. So if people back one petition, not the other, I mean, there's nothing stopping folks from signing all of them. But what you have now is folks sniping one or the other.
Okay. No state that has gotten this on the ballot has seen it go down. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. Once the voter gets their say, I mean, people at this point, people have seen that this is the way of the future.
Shelton Hall, this is one of those rare issues, too, that has bipartisan support in Florida and across the country.
Absolutely. A lot of the medical marijuana amendments were first passed around the country in the 1990s. I think about eight states had essentially legalized by 2001, and the Supreme Court overruled it, saying that under the Bush administration, saying that the federal law trumps the state law, so they had to go back to ground zero to get restarted again on that. And what's happened is, I think a big thing that's driven the bipartisan support is our veteran community. If you look at a state like Florida, we have a heavy veteran community, a heavy seniors community, and that's kind of driven a lot of the support for it around the country. And then once they started, what really did it was the wave of money coming through, billions of dollars just in tax revenue with no increase in crime, actually a decrease in crime in places like Colorado and California, increased tax revenue.
Okay. Sally Kent Peebles, can you explain a little bit, as our lawyer here in the mix, there's a lawsuit dealing with how medical marijuana is distributed around the state. That's another sort of wrinkle to this story right now, isn't it?
Absolutely. So last year, a judge determined that certain aspects of the marijuana statute that implemented Amendment 2 were unconstitutional, specifically required vertical integration and the cap on licenses at the state level. And for those who don't know what vertical integration is, it's just a structure by which one company controls each and every stage of the product's production and sale. Like, one company has to cultivate, process, sale, and transport marijuana. That makes running these companies very expensive. This case, it's called the Floregrown case, has been appealed all the way to the Florida Supreme Court. And last week, the Supreme Court decided they're going to take it up on appeal. So that's exciting news. If the Florida Supreme Court confirms the lower court's decision, then the legislature will need to recreate the marijuana license structure for medical marijuana here, and potentially allow horizontal licensure. So if a person wanted to go get a license, they could just focus on one aspect of the chain. They could just open a dispensary or just open a cultivation.
Marilyn is in Riverside. Hey, Marilyn, good morning.
Good morning. I support medical marijuana legalization, and I think there's so many huge benefits to it. My question would be, given all the huge medical benefits for legalizing medical marijuana, what is the primary reason that people are opposed?
Let's talk about the case against it. Now, let's be clear, you guys are in favor of this. The majority of Floridians polled say they're in favor of it. Not everyone is. Let's talk about the case against legalizing recreational pot?
Yeah, I don't think there is much of a case, and as the years go by and as people see what's happened with the medical experiment, as Shelton mentioned, seniors, veterans, people who would normally lean conservative, they're seeing the benefits of this, and that opens the door for recreational adult legal use. I think one of the problems that we're having in the petition drive that threatens this even being brought to the general voter in November is the sticking point of vertical integration, which Sally mentioned. And so this is something that the activists want to be able to grow their own. I understand that. And one of the petitions, the Make It Legal petition, is based on a vertical integration model. And folks like Miami New Times, our sister alt weekly down in Miami, have suggested that opens the door to monopoly. I get it. That's a problem, but it's a starting point. If we can get this on the ballot, if we can get it legal, and we can move on from there, because that Make It Legal petition has a lot of money behind it because of its kind of corporate nature.
Mark is in St. Augustine. Hello, Mark.
Hey, good morning. I, as a libertarian and a believer in states' rights, I'm all for putting it on the ballot, voting for it, passing it, all that kind of good stuff. But I'm just curious about how does this supersede federal restrictions on marijuana? Because my understanding is that's still a federally restricted product. And that even though you might not get a lot of pushback from Washington, it would seem that at any time, if somebody really wanted to, they can supersede all the states that have voted so far to enact, you know, this type of legislation.
Yeah. Mark, thanks so much for bringing that up, because that is a real issue in the states.
Yes.
There's a gray area legally, Shelton, between what all of the states are doing with regard to cannabis and where the federal government is. And how is the country going to work through that?
Well, for example, here in Florida, the first attempts to get a marijuana petition on the ballot started around 1994. And there's a lot of pushback, largely driven by the federal government, driven largely by the kind of stereotypes and propaganda that kind of animated that market from going back to the 1930s, the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, for example. In terms of the federal government, they still reserve the right to come in, and it's still a Schedule I narcotic. It's regulated the same way cocaine, heroin, you know, things like that are. But what we see now is, for example, Ron DeSantis, our governor, has taken a largely hands-off approach. He and Nikki Fried, you know, DeSantis, a conservative Republican, Fried, a liberal Democrat, were both elected in 2018 by decent margins, and Fried actually got a higher percentage of the vote than DeSantis did. He's kind of allowed her to take the lead on that. And Washington could step in and do it, but many of the states that these senators and congressmen are from, they're seeing the results already. And of course, the White House is busy with all kinds of other stuff, so they're not looking at it.
549-2937, lots of calls. Bill is at the beaches. Hey, Bill. Oh, Bill.
Great.
Hung up.
Thank you.
We lost Bill. But he was against legalization, for the record. Courtney is in San Jose. Hi, Courtney. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. My question is directed towards the guest from Colorado, and I was hoping she could elaborate on the tax benefits that were seen with the marijuana legalization in Colorado and what that did for their public schools.
Yeah, thanks for that. Sally, bring us the perspective from Colorado, how that worked there.
Absolutely. And to clarify, I actually do live in Florida. I just spent the last 20 years in Colorado, and that's where I cut my teeth on the industry. Recreational marijuana is, I believe, a 35% excise tax, where medical is much less. So we do get taxes from both in Colorado. That money, a lot of it is allocated towards schools' infrastructure. So it's not going to teacher salaries. It's going to building schools, putting in better, more updated buildings and plumbing and things like that. And that has been a large benefit. Also, cities are able to use their money. You know, it's not just state tax, but city tax are getting money from properties, and we've seen recreational centers being built for children. I know Aurora has a really incredible one, state-of-the-art facility that their community is enjoying. And city in Pueblo is using it to fund grants to send underprivileged children to college. So there's many different ways they're using it, and it's an exciting development, and I think that's something that shouldn't be overlooked.
Roseanne on the South Bank tweets the show, I am for recreational marijuana in Florida. Even though I did vote no on the last ballot measure, as the way the bill was written regarding distribution, I thought it was monopolistic. I don't partake, but Florida is ready. Okay, so that brings us back to voters might have to confront a couple of different ballot initiatives next year, Georgia. One would allow more people to grow the stuff. One would restrict it to a small pool of growers who would get the lion's share of the money, right?
That's correct. And I think realistically that quasi-monopolistic initiative is the one that has the kind of corporate backing to get those signatures. So that is the one likely we're going to see. But at the same time, as Sally mentioned, there are cases making their way through court that could just crack open that vertical integration model. So this is not going to be the final word. And I think 20 is the year to get this legal, and then let's move on from there. But there's plenty of time to evolve once we get this written into law.
Bill is at the beaches. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Yes, it's not surprising that people who like to get high would like to do more of it. But the more important factor is that, you know, the state of Florida spent billions of dollars and shook down tobacco companies to get that money to tell people that the cigarette is a bad thing for them. And what you want to do is take the equivalent of a cigarette, probably more potent than a cigarette, and make it okay for people to do at will all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, what will happen is you will grow an industry in Florida that will become a multi-billion dollar industry. 30 years from now, the government will sue that industry and take the money to tell them not to do drugs. So why not just don't do it to begin with? And I'd like to hear your comments off the
Yeah, air. Thanks for that, Bill. All right. Smoking marijuana isn't good for your lungs.
No.
Vaping CBD oil, dangers have been brought to light recently about that and the possible damage to the lungs, Shelton. You know, and let's also be clear that we're not talking about marijuana as a gateway drug to harder drugs. Those theories have largely been debunked. But what about Bill's point that smoking this product is not good for you?
Well, I mean, you know, putting anything in your lungs isn't necessarily good for you. That's why we got rid of the paper mills. The old, you know, the old stereotype about marijuana, especially going back to 1937, the initial push to criminalize marijuana was based primarily on the argument that if you go out there and you start smoking marijuana, you're going to end up hanging out with black people, hanging out with Mexicans,
and God forbid,
and listening to lots of jazz music. And that is true. If you don't like jazz music, you have to consider that. Now, the idea that when you open the door to freedom for anyone, there is that possibility for abuse. But what we've seen so far is it's not that big a deal. They talk about marijuana as a gateway drug. And, you know, I'm strictly like a tap water and peppermints guy, so I'm playing catch up. But as far as the idea of it being a gateway drug, we already have a multi-billion dollar narcotics industry in the black market in Florida, and that's driven a lot of this crime we're seeing. Legalizing marijuana will, first and foremost, undercut the profits of the cartels and reduce violence like we've seen in California, Oregon, Colorado.
Sally, how has that played out in Colorado? Because it's certainly a cash crop for Colorado. At the same time, some parents out there have expressed concern that the drug is readily available to kids. So what about that?
Regulated marijuana is not readily available to children. Recreational marijuana, you have to have an ID and be 21 or over to purchase it. So, and to be a medical patient, you actually have to have a medical card. So regulation hasn't flooded the market with more marijuana for kids to access. If anything, it's reduced the black market. So that should be clear. But second of all, to your caller's point earlier, he mentioned that marijuana, a joint, and a cigarette are equally as bad, and that's just not scientifically true. There's never been a single death from a marijuana consumer that's smoking just marijuana. Take away these vape deaths that we don't know what the cause of that is. While nicotine and cigarette smoking killed 500,000 people a year in this country. So I think that should be, you know, there should be a distinction there. But yes, we have seen crime go down in areas where legalization is. We see opioid abuse and addiction go down marijuana has been shown to treat opioid addiction. So really, it's not, I feel like the caller earlier just did a little bit more research, because these are, this is a less harmful substance than cigarettes and certainly less harmful than alcohol.
Joe is at the beaches. Hey, Joe, how are you?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a paramedic and an ER nurse, and all my memories for doing it for years, I don't ever remember, you know, treating somebody for a marijuana overdose. But unfortunately, you know, I've had to treat many people for opioid overdoses and even alcohol overdoses. I'm not a marijuana smoker, and I don't have any intention of smoking it if it ever becomes legalized. But just like this young lady was just talking, it doesn't seem to be as as harmful physically to people as I think a lot of people think it is. And even you don't even have to smoke it. You know, I'm sure they make edibles and things like that with marijuana. So, you know, long-term lung damage might not even be a factor.
Thanks, Joe. Okay, an ER nurse there talking about how this all relates to the opioid epidemic, Giorgio. There is some data to show, I believe, that in states that have legalized cannabis, they've seen opioid abuse decline somewhat. What are your thoughts?
And Sally just mentioned that. I mean, we have real data that we can look at from places like Colorado, and the experience that those states have had is that legalizing recreational marijuana is not the end of the world. And I think the caller we heard earlier, that argument that was presented is, I don't think there's a lot of currency to that argument. I don't think a lot of people subscribe to a lot of those knee-jerk reactions anymore after seeing the reality of legal medical marijuana in Florida and recreational in other states.
Cheryl is in Arlington. Hey, Cheryl, thanks for holding.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a couple of questions. One is, how do you get involved in circulating petitions to get it on the ballot? And two, I was hit by a semi that ran a red light and have a spinal cord injury. Therefore, I am on painkillers. I would like to be able to decrease it. My doctor has said that she's okay with prescribing it. However, I've been told that it's extremely expensive, and I'm just on Social Security. But I am in favor for legalization of recreational marijuana, too, and because it's the tax revenue, the decrease in crime, it's not as harmful as alcohol and tobacco. But it's like I said, my two questions mainly are how to get involved in the petition drive, and number two, I have a lot of questions about medical marijuana, because I would like to be able to decrease my pain meds. I'm very strictly regimented on it. Number one, because I would run out of my pain meds if I overdid it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think those of us who truly need it for chronic pain, it's are very conservative with its use, but with the marijuana, I'd be able to either hold steady or decrease. Another thing I've been told is that if I were to get medical marijuana, I could have one or the other. I can't do my pain meds and still have medical marijuana. Plus, the cost, I've been told, is prohibited.
Okay, Cheryl.
Social Security.
All right. Thanks. Yeah, I hear you. Cheryl, thanks for that. Sally Kent Peebles, we hear this a lot from folks that want access to the drug. What about that? And also her question about the petition drives.
Well, it sounds like she has a doctor who's willing to prescribe it to her. So I would, you know, urge her to take that pathway and work with closely with her physician. She mentioned the cost of the product. I think, you know, we see in other regulated states as more companies get involved in selling it, you know, and there's more competition between the licensees, then costs will go down. But you're right, it is quite expensive at this time. Regulate Florida, which is one of the two ballot initiatives, does have that home grow in it, and it also distinctively has the ability for new entrants into the market. So it doesn't just limit the sales of recreational marijuana to the existing MMTCs, but it allows new people to be licensed to sell and cultivate. And if you open up the system like that to new entrants, you'll have a lot more companies and a lot more competition, and of course the prices would fall then, and make it much more accessible to people.
Lots of calls as we talk about the push to legalize marijuana for recreational use in Florida. You may get to vote on this next year when you go to the polls in November to choose a new president. Haley is at the beaches. Haley, hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
So I have one question. I'm wondering the law for advertising cannabis, mainly on the television, because I think a big reason for the confusion of cannabis being a gateway drug is because people who are not pro-cannabis don't really understand the benefits, like this woman who just called before. She doesn't want to take opioids, and she absolutely shouldn't. And I think that a lot of people maybe who were born around the 60s are stuck on these commercials where they made it sound so terrible. But if we could produce a ton of commercials that spoke to people, that maybe we could get more signatures.
Thanks, Haley. Giorgio.
I suspect if the initiative gets on the ballot, then you're going to see a lot of campaigning in that regard. Up until this point, it's been sort of people have been finding out, you know, the hard way just by getting injured and then using medical marijuana that, you know what, this is actually useful, this is beneficial, and this is a whole lot better than a lot of these addictive substances that are freely prescribed all over the country.
Jody on the South Side. Hi, Jody. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm obviously going to have a minority position, it sounds like, listening to your show, as my personal experience is quite contrary. I'm in a marriage where my husband used morning on the way to work, at noon, during lunch, and on the way home. It absolutely modified behavior, compromised performance at work. He couldn't keep a job because of it. So when I hear comments like, oh, it's just pot, it makes me cringe. And while it maybe isn't clinically proven that it was a gateway to stronger use, there is a lifestyle change that comes with regular use. And then when it can't be afforded, okay, his idea was to deal in it so that he could afford it. And one thing led to another, from violence a failed marriage and violence inside the home and outside the home. Additionally, I have a son-in-law who started with, quote, just pot use occasionally. And it did lead, absolutely led, because of the locations where someone uses and the people they hang around. And it led to a fatal overdose of that did have pot in the system and stronger drugs. So it sounds like I'm in a minority, but to think that it doesn't lead to destruction, self-destruction, relationship destruction, is naive.
Thanks, Jody. No, and I appreciate that. And that is the argument against full legalization, that it hasn't been a successful argument in any of the states where the voters have decided, Shelton. However, what she's talking about is real. In terms of some people who have trouble managing their use of this drug. It's a stereotype to talk about a stoner or a pothead, but it's a real thing for some people. What about that argument?
Well, it's legitimate. You know, a lot of that goes to the issue of mental illness. The fact is, not everyone can have freedom. Some people have to have their activities regulated. If your marriage is falling apart, if you're out there getting in trouble, engaging in violence, the drugs aren't the problem. They talk about marijuana as a gateway drug to other substances, but our state is already saturated with all this stuff that's supposed to be marijuana being the gateway drug too. Going back to what the lady that was hit by the semi, I want to say to her that medical marijuana now, if you want to get your license, it costs about $75 or so. We have over 150,000 people with medical marijuana licenses now, and none of that includes THC. THC is a psychoactive compound that makes you high. The CBD is for pain relief, anti-inflammatory and whatnot. And someone in her case might want to try maybe edibles, maybe oils, maybe lotions. And if you want to get involved in the petition drive, Regulate Florida and Make It Legal Jacks, you just Google them and you can sign up through them and you can go and become one of the petition people.
Nikki at the beaches. Go ahead, Nikki.
Hi, Melissa. My question was about the current people who are sitting in jail for possession charges. What in the law is going to release them or overturn their charges?
That is a great question for our lawyer, Sally Kent Peeble. Sally.
Hi there. Yes. So some states are addressing that and doing mass expungement. It's been a pretty exciting development in some other states. We haven't seen that in Florida yet, but there's certainly groups, including my law firm, that are pushing for things like that. So there have been some releases, but I know California has been leading the charge on that.
Okay. With all of that said, pick up this week's Folio Weekly, learn more, and thank you to Giorgio Valentino and Shelton Hull of Folio, Sally Kent Peebles, member of the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Up next, author Chris Hand on the state of Jacksonville's consolidation. Stay with us.
WJCT's podcast Oddball is a Jacksonville story about a UFO investigation, a mansion in the woods, and how one shiny object silenced a family.
Cherry just wanted to know what it was.
She would have a gut instinct and she would pursue it.
After a while, it's just too much publicity. She just not want to talk about it anymore.
Can we put the mystery of the strange metal ball to rest? Check it out at oddballpodcast.com.
Take a drive with us into the blues horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, once a decade, the definitive book on this city's history of consolidation gets an update. Guess what? That update has happened again. Author Chris Hand, former chief of staff to Jacksonville Mayor Alvin Brown, is here now with the latest on the book, A Quiet Revolution. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks so much for being with us. Of course, we do have a consolidated city-county government, have for half a century or so. This book gets updated regularly because things change in this city. So what's new in the book right now?
Well, you know, over the last year, we have commemorated the 50th anniversary of consolidation, which started on October 1st, 1968, when the consolidated government took place. As part of that commemoration, in conjunction with the Jacksonville Historical Society and the task force chaired by Matt Carlucci, we decided to update A Quiet Revolution. And what the book covers is about the last 10 to 12 years of consolidated history, really from the second term of Mayor Payton through to Mayor Curry's term. That's the sort of retrospective part of the book. But then there's a prospective part of the book. With the Charter Revision Commission meeting now and exploring the future of consolidated government, the second part of the book identifies the issues which may impact the next 50 years of consolidation.
Does consolidation still work for this city, or is it showing some cracks that make good governance difficult?
It's an interesting debate and one that we try to reflect in the book. You know, I think what advocates would say is that consolidation has provided efficiencies and accountabilities. You have to remember what consolidation came out of. The schools had been disaccredited. Multiple local government officials had been indicted. The city was in fiscal crisis. So consolidation really helped to right the ship and has provided efficiency and accountability and allowed the city to work on some big projects. However, there are folks who have concerns about consolidation. Because we're so big, individual neighborhoods don't always get the individualized attention they might if there were a city of Mandarin or of Arlington or of Durkeyville or West Gannett. And then, of course, there are significant sections of the community that are concerned that promises that were made during the consolidation campaign to provide infrastructure and funding to places like Northwest and East Jacksonville, that those promises have not yet been fulfilled and the benefits of consolidation haven't stretched to the entire community. So that's why this Charter Revision Commission process is so important, because it's a chance for the public to engage, mm-hmm. for citizens to get involved and participate in those debates about what our consolidated government looks like.
Let's talk about the big debate happening in this city right now, the push to privatize JEA, and look at that in the context of our form of government. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not sure there's a consolidation issue related there, because there's obviously a process that's outlined in the charter. What we did cover in the book is the relationship between independent authorities in general and the city of Jacksonville. You know, what we did for each mayoral administration was pick an issue in consolidation that evolved during that time. For John Payton, it was the strong mayor system. For Alvin Brown, it was how the principles of consolidation helped with economic development. For Lenny Curry, it was the city's relationship with the independent authorities and a reconsolidation of authority. The issue we kind of pose for the future of consolidation isn't related to any one particular independent agency, but to all of them. In other words, the question are the independent authorities under our charter, are they too independent or not independent enough? And we discuss that in the book and, you know, throw out some ideas the Charter Revision Commission might want to consider based on interviews we did. We did almost 35 interviews for the book, as to how members of the independent authorities should be appointed and approved by council, or even whether, for example, those independent authorities that are state-created, like JTA and the Jacksonville Airport Authority and Jaxport, ought to come within the charter and be city-appointed and city agencies at that point. So that's really the debate we covered. Are they independent or not independent enough? There are some strong feelings on that, and those are reflected in the book.
It's 549-2937 as we talk with author Chris Hand. You know, this is one of the only cities in America that decided to do this some decades ago, consolidate city and county government. It was done because there was so much political corruption going on at the time, and this was seen as a way to root that out and have a more efficient form of governance. Duval County is a huge county, Chris. We are the largest city by landmass, or the second largest city by landmass in America. So, does it make sense still to have this form of government when the needs of the folks in Baldwin are so different than the needs of people at the beaches or downtown?
Well, I think the prevailing, and again, what I tried to do in the book was really reflect the opinions of the almost 35 people, former mayors, former council presidents, community leaders that we interviewed. And I think the prevailing sentiment among those would be, mend it, don't end it. In other words, that there are changes that can be made to the consolidated model. There are improvements. There are promises that were made that can be fulfilled over time, but that the basic consolidated model gives Jacksonville an advantage, particularly in efficiency and accountability. I think if people read the book, they'll see some interesting suggestions from a variety of the people we interviewed about how the consolidated model might be tweaked to give some additional authority, for example, to individual neighborhoods to help fulfill the unfulfilled promises of the 1967 consolidation campaign, to maybe look at the size and structure of the Jacksonville City Council.
Is it too big?
Well, that's an interesting question, whether it's too big, whether we should have more district seats or more at-large seats. All issues we explore in this 50th anniversary update to A Quiet Revolution, and also issues like, are city elections scheduled at the right time? So the way it's posed in the book, Melissa, we pose those five questions for the next 50 years of consolidation, and doing it at a time the Charter Revision Commission is exploring just that.
The big thing about the consolidated model is the so-called independent authorities. They are supposed to be free of politics. Under Mayor Lenny Curry, critics say they have become politicized as he purged those authorities and boards of the people that were on them and stacked them with loyalists. Is this a flaw in the consolidation model that it didn't account for this type of situation that we now have?
I don't know that it would be a flaw. I think what you've seen in the history of consolidation, Melissa, is that there's been a waxing and waning in the authority of the city of Jacksonville and the independent authorities. At times, there's been more alignment, like perhaps there is now. At other times, there's been less alignment. You know, one of the people I interviewed was former council president Bill Bishop, and he put it very well when he said, it's really a question of how do you decide that balance between operational independence and strategic alignment. We're all part of the same consolidated government, so there's a hope that there's a shared vision and an alignment on big matters or on overarching strategic matters. But, you know, how do you do that and also provide some operational independence? So I think we've seen this move back and forth where at times cities have had more control over independent authorities, at times they've had less.
John is downtown. Hi, John.
Well, hello, Melissa and Chris, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I've been participating in the Charter Revision Commission, and the question I have, and I also had it for the Charter Revision Commission, and that has to do with the CRAs and DIAs. You know, those are Community Redevelopment Agencies and the Downtown Investment Authority, and it really has to do with the charter, and in the sense that, for example, if taxpayer money is given to a certain entity, and my question really has to do with the waterways, you know, throughout the consolidated area of Jacksonville, and the point is, will public access to that waterway be guaranteed to Joe Q Public, you know, when utilizing taxpayer money in those CRAs and DIAs? And that is something that the Charter Revision Commission could address. And real quickly, last night at the Jacksonville City Council meeting, there was legislation that passed unanimously, and maybe Chris can touch on it, but it was introduced by Councilman Freeman, and co-sponsors were Gaffney and Morgan. There was zero discussion, passed unanimously, but had to do with redevelopment trust funds.
Okay.
And thank you.
Yeah, the redevelopment trust, so thank you for that. That has to do with putting more money into a fund for keeping up historic downtown buildings. But he had a few questions there. So what about that?
Well, first, I want to commend John for participating in the Charter Revision Commission process. I saw him there when I spoke to the commission in September, and I want to encourage everybody to go to those meetings, participate in that process, get involved, communicate with the commission, share your views. That's extremely important. I think what John is referring to is a couple of different issues. One, the overall issue of how do different parts of consolidated government work together. In this case, he's speaking specifically to the issue of waterways. And there's an interesting situation, as John knows, during the time I was at City Hall when Mayor Brown was in office, there was a big push to provide access to waterways. And of course, former council president Lori Boyer, who is now the CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority, that's been a huge priority of hers as well. And it's interesting to watch the different elements of consolidated government work together, whether it's an authority like the DIA, whether it's the city council or the mayor's office, come together around those community priorities. I think what many people would argue that that's an easier sort of strategy to put together and to harmonize under consolidation than it is under other forms of government.
The book is out now. Are you going to be doing any appearances?
We will. It's available on Amazon. It's also available at Chamberlain's and will soon be available at other local bookstores as well. And we just want to participate in this consolidation conversation. Again, urge people to take part in that Charter Revision Commission process.
They are still meeting and asking for the public's input.
They are.
Yes. So Chris Hand, author, former chief of staff to Mayor Alvin Brown, and attorney. It's an update to the book, A Quiet Revolution. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
A quick break, and in a moment, October is autumn, which is always a nice time of year. It's also Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Find out what's being done here in Northeast Florida to protect those at risk. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Organ, winds, and percussion is the Jacksonville Symphony's third annual concert, featuring the wonderful musicians of the symphony and Greg Zelek on the mighty Bryan concert organ. It will be an afternoon of powerful music. November 3rd. Tickets and more at jacksymphony.org. Mm-hmm.
In the Northwest, loggers and environmentalists are teaming up to find solutions for the growing threat of wildfires.
What I find is that people who don't want to collaborate typically throw darts from a distance. They don't get out on the ground, they don't read the science, or they selectively pick science.
I'm Audie Cornish. A Truce in the Timber Wars, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, as concerns rise about the possible resurgence of ISIS, we'll get a firsthand account of the 2017 battle to drive the terrorist group from Mosul, Iraq's second largest city. Our guest will be journalist James Verini, author of the new book, They Will Have to Die Now, Mosul and the Fall of the Caliphate. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Madeleine Albright chooses her words carefully.
If you pluck a chicken one feather at a time, nobody notices. And there's a lot of feather plucking going on right now. And you can't say those two words together too quickly.
No, you can't.
The first female Secretary of State on America's responsibility to do more than see something and say something. Madeleine Albright. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and cases of domestic violence are on the rise in counties throughout our area. We're taking a closer look now with Gail Payton, who leads Hubbard House, and Joyce Marr, who leads Betty Griffin Center in St. Johns County. Ladies, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Gail, let's start with you. Hubbard House, of course, is renowned for providing shelter and services to women and men dealing with domestic violence. What are you seeing right now in the community?
Well, unfortunately, we're still seeing people needing services. We have a 116-bed facility, which stays at capacity almost all of the time. And then this last year, in 2018, we review all of the fatalities. And last year, we had 12 intimate domestic violence homicides, and children were present and witnessed this. So we're seeing the need is still there. We're still here to meet that need, but it would be great to come to a time where we don't have domestic violence at all in our society.
Joyce, CEO of Betty Griffin House in St. John's, this is the last thing we want to hear, is that you're dealing with an uptick. Why do you think?
Well, I think part of it is the growth in the county. We're the eighth fastest growing county in the nation. And so we're absolutely seeing the uptick in services, in emergency shelter. I just looked at the report, and out of the last quarter, there was only 5 days that we were not over capacity. And we have a 56-bed facility, and we're typically at anywhere from 60 to 64.
Wow. Let's explain what the scope of services are at both Hubbard House and Betty Griffin Center. Gail, let's start with Hubbard House.
Okay. Well, you know, for instance, I was at a presentation yesterday, and a woman came to me and she said, I thought Hubbard House only did shelter services because that's how we're started and that's what we're known for. We do have shelter for those who are in most need, but we also have an outreach center where people can walk in during the week, during regular business hours, just to talk to somebody, to find out what's going on with their situation, to get resources. We also have support groups throughout the community. We provide services to children as well as adults. We have attorneys who help people get injunctions for protections at the courthouse. We go out and do community education in the community to raise that awareness amongst everybody. Mm-hmm. So we really do a lot of wraparound services in addition to shelter.
Betty Griffin Center does too.
Yes, we do. And we do some of the very similar services as well. But we have transitional housing where we have six apartments where survivors can make application to go live for up to 18 months. We have advocates at the state attorney's office. We work closely with the sheriff's office. And also we have a batter accountability specialist, and we have therapists on staff as well.
Okay. When someone is trying to leave an abusive relationship, that can often be the most dangerous time. What advice do you have for people out there in that situation that need your help?
Well, if they're planning to need, they really need to call the hotline, whether it's to Hubbard House or Betty Griffin Center, because that is the most dangerous time, and they need to do it very thoughtfully and develop a safety plan around it. And do not alert the abuser that you're planning to leave, because that will put the abuser on alert and things can escalate from there pretty quickly.
Call the hotline. Let's give the hotline number.
It's 1-800-500-1119, and it will link you with your closest domestic violence center.
Either one of you ladies, 1-800-500-1119. Joyce, what else should we know in the context of this month being Domestic Violence Awareness Month?
Well, you know, domestic violence is, you know, promoted during the month of October, but everyone needs to realize that when October the 31st stops, there needs to be continued awareness, because abuse happens 365 days a year, and we need to be supporting victims out there as much as we can, and to definitely encourage them to reach out to get help. There's always an advocate on the other end of the line or some of our outreach centers to get services and really do safety planning with the victims.
There is help. If you're in an abusive relationship, reach out. Make the call to either Hubbard House or Betty Griffin House. There are shelters in other outlying counties too. But if you call that hotline number, you will get connected to the closest one to you. Again, that number is 1-800-500-1119. Make the call. And thank you so much, Gail and Betty. You know, it's always good to have you on, because the work you do is so incredibly important in this community. Thanks for all you do to help survivors.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing awareness through this show.
Yes, absolutely. It's really important that our community hears of our services.
Again, it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so be aware that help is available. We spoke just now with Gail Payton, CEO at Hubbard House in Duval County, and Betty Griffin, Joyce Marr, who runs the Betty Griffin Center in Duval County. Again, it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so reach out for help and support. And thanks so much for listening today, everyone. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum directs the show. The station news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. We always want your feedback. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, a new poll shows a split electorate in Florida when it comes to whether or not President Trump should be impeached. We'll take a closer look tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, just keep listening for some great music. And we'll see you tomorrow morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.